towards against Japan, and that they were losing quite a few of the planes, not due to enemy fire, but due to the fact that the weather conditions were such that they run into storms, run out of gas, and would have to come down in enemy territory. And they wondered whether we could develop equipment so that we could follow the electrical storms over the continent, over the Japanese area. Well, of course, for this didn't seem to be too difficult because we could follow lightning, and what we were looking for were hurricanes, and but this was not the hurricane; these were regular lightning storms. So we told them we thought we could do that, and so then we got our contract on what was known as SFRERIX, S-F-R-E-R-I-C-S. It's an abbreviation of atmospherics. And atmospherics is a technical name for the electrical discharges that one finds in the air, mostly lightning. And so we then did some research at the University of Florida, leading to the development of what the Army called its Army SFRERIX equipment. And we have commendation from the armed forces stating that we not only developed the Army SFRERIX network, trained the people in its use, but when they couldn't get it from the production lines to meet the needs of the War Department, that we changed the research laboratory to a production production, and made them so they could have the use over for the need that they had in over the continent, flying the planes to Japan. Well, that was one contract we had with reference to the war effort, and which we apparently did a good job. The Ordnance Department had a problem, and that was that the Navy had developed what was known as a proximity fuse. The proximity fuse was a unique device in that when it was attached to a missile, that it would send out an electric signal, and then that signal would be bounced back from the plane or target and be received at the point from which the missile was fired. The combination would then cause a triggered effect which would cause the missile to blow up and hit the target, hopefully. In other words, it was a fuse which, when attached to a missile, could go to a target and then be actuated when it got near the target. The particular fuse that the Navy had developed, work was being was rather large in size, about the size of a quart bottle, and the ordnance wanted it to be materially reduced so it could be used on lighter missiles. And furthermore, so that our project was to endeavor to use a generator without so that we wouldn't have to wouldn't use batteries. We developed a small fuse in which you had a small turbine which was operated from the air flowing through the unit as it moved through the air. And this turbine would drive a generator which would make electricity which then could be rectified and caused to operate and a radio transmitter which would send out a radio signal. This radio signal then would go forth over the antenna, and if it got, when it would be then would be bounced back from the target, and under at a when a certain difference between the sending wave and the receiving wave occurred, this would then operate the mechanism to set off the missile. The unit that we made was about as large as your fist, and it worked pretty satisfactory. It has one objection, however, was that it was not directional, and sometimes it would go off while it would go over, when it flew over trees, and if our people were under those trees, it would be very bad. So we developed what was, it was called a UFTR, the UF, of course, being University of Florida, missile, I mean fuse.
Don't tell me the TR was trees.
Huh?
Don't tell me the TR was trees. UFTR. No.
I don't know what the TR stand for, to tell you the truth. But UF I do. And we then put in a little ring in the front of the thing, and that gave it directional activities, so it had forward sensitivity and not sideways sensitivity. And so we got the commendation for that.
That was probably the single most important research activity, wasn't it, associated with the university?
Not only with the university, but with the entire war effort. Vannevar Bush said the war was won when we dropped the atomic bomb. And he said the most important development was a proximity fuse. And while we can't say that we developed a proximity fuse, we certainly aided in the development of that fuse very materially. Mm-hmm. That was another one. Now, getting back to after the war, we did quite a lot of work with radar, and as a result, why the weather weather forecasting that you now see on your TV screen, where you see these radar pictures of the weather conditions on the radar on the TV screen, the first picture of that type was developed at the University of Florida in the radar station that's back of the football field, and it's still there. Mm-hmm. And those are some of the most important things that we developed, I'd say, through the war.
Weren't you also very much interested in the development of plastics?
Plastics? No.
I remembered that you had developed a method of using, you know, the flowers and that kind of thing.
I wouldn't put that in the same class with this stuff. Mm-hmm. In other words, the other thing that I think we should talk about is that I think the largest induction heating unit that was ever built was probably the one that we had built at the University of Florida. But when I say induction unit, I'm talking about the so-called electronic or radar stoves that you now see. The problem that the government had in sending up missiles was that when they re-entered the atmosphere, their high velocity was so high that they would be heated up on the outside. The heat would be so intense that the metal would be disintegrated, on a fish, the scales on a fish, they would scale. Mm-hmm. And that way the whole thing would deteriorate. So they wanted to know what could be done to test materials that could be made so that you had safe reentry. And in order to do this, the first thing you said, well, put them in a high-velocity wind tunnel. But the trouble with a high-velocity wind tunnel, you get one quick puff of air and then you're through. This had to be something which was practically continuous. So we got the idea that if you had induction heating, you would get only surface heat. And then this way you would assimilate the same thing that you would get on reentry from the atmosphere. And on that basis, we did a little experimentation. We took a little induction heating unit that you find frequently in the offices of some doctors who use electrolysis for certain things, and we found that we could get surface heating. And then we got a few thousand dollars from the government to try it on a bigger scale. And then we used some old equipment that we had from the radio station. And then this went up until we got appropriations of $1 million. And so we built the final, this thing was a unit about 12 feet high and about 15 feet per 15 feet. So that it was a rather large induction heating unit. And you could stick a pretty good sized missile in there and throw the switch, and you'd get the same effect as if you were entering the atmosphere at high velocity.
I want to leave the College of Engineering and get back to Joe Wild now, if I may. And I want to ask you about your interest in students and your involvement in students. And I want to lead that into the work that you did in helping organize the fraternity. You and Mrs. Wild were always very close to student activities and life on the campus.
Well, the education of a student is much more than just teaching him what's in books or what a professor knows from a scientific and technical standpoint. An engineer, after all, if he's going to be a professional man, has to learn how to get along with people on the outside. He has to learn how to like people. He has to overlook the faults of people and see the good points. And if that's the case, you make friends. And to us, every student was like one of our own children, you might say. And we tried to get to know them. Frequently, I would know a student in such a way that I would know who he's going to marry before his parents did. Students sometimes would borrow my automobile or something like that if we're going to take a girl out and so on. And I had no, I mean, I think that we'd have them over the house for different, they'd feel free to come to our house almost any time. If they had a problem, they would bring us the problem. They knew us not only as a member of the faculty, but as a friend. A beautiful example of that, I think, occurred one time. I got a call from Mr. Klein Graham, who was the business manager. He told me that someone had stolen three motors from the roof of the chemistry building that were used to drive ventilators. And he thinks there were students who did it. And I went over there and I looked at the problem, and I did feel that it was probably, may have been students, and it looked like if they knew a little about electricity in order to do it, and so I took a chance. And I taught the laboratory at that time, electrical laboratory, and I used to go over the students' reports with them. And for the class, I mentioned the fact that these motors were gone, and if anyone had any information about them, I hope they would tell me about it. Well, whenever a student came in, I looked over his report just facetiously, I would say to him, you don't know anything about those motors, do you? And in every case, they said no. But when I got home at 5 o'clock, shortly thereafter, who appears at the doorway but three of the most troubled young men that I've ever seen. And they greeted me with a statement. They don't know how I found out that they had taken those motors. But they had taken the motors. So what'd you do with them? Well, we took them over in the car to Jacksonville and we sold them. Well, that was quite a problem. Now, here were the boys who stole these motors, and here were the motors gone, and so forth. I said, well, now the first thing you have to do is to get those motors and get them back. I said, well, if we get them back, he said, then how are we going to get them back without them finding out that we did it? I said, well, I'll tell you what I'll do. I won't turn you in, since you've come to me voluntarily, but I can't promise you that just as I found out that you had done it, that somebody else might not find out. And if they do, why, what they do, I won't have any, I can't control, but I will not turn you in if you get those motors back. So So they got the motors, and they brought them back, and they put them in the dynamo laboratory of the electrical of the college. I called up Mr. Graham the next day and told him that apparently some students had taken these motors from the chemistry building, and they have returned. He said, "Who were they?" I said, "Well, I'm very sorry. I've told the students that I would not divulge their names." "Well, you got to." I said, "No, I don't got to either." I said, "You've got your motors, and that closes as far as I'm concerned." I said, "Well, we got a discussion about it." And I said, "Well, I'll tell you what I'll do. I'll tell the students that you want to know who did it, and that I will not, if they on their own want to come to you and tell you what they did, why, that's up to them then, but I will not turn them in." Well, the result was that I told the students what had occurred, and they decided they'd go over to see Mr. Graham, and that Mr. Graham and tell him what happened, and which they did. Mr. Graham turned him over to the discipline committee, talked it over to the president, and they turned him over to the discipline committee. And the discipline committee then met, and they called me in as a witness. And one of the questions they asked me, "Didn't I think it was my duty and responsibility to turn these boys in?" I said, "If I did, I would have turned them in." I said, "The only thing I can tell you is, I treated those boys as if my own son made a mistake. I hope somebody would be just as considerate as I was." Well, the result was that the committee hit them very hard. I don't think two of the boys ever did finish college. One of them finished college elsewhere. Well, I'll get some more, I can give you some more along those somewhat lines if you want.
Yeah, well, I want to find out how the fraternity, because I think that's an important thing that we need to record, how the fraternity got organized.
Well,
did they come to you? Were you a fraternity man?
No. I did not believe in fraternities when I was at school. You got it on? I did not believe in fraternities when I was at school, and I didn't join any fraternities. I had neither the time nor the money to do so. But I did see a factor which bothered me considerably. Fraternity life was a very aggressive part of university life on the campus of the University of Florida. From a social standpoint, it was very pronounced. There was very little social life among the students who were not involved in fraternities. Furthermore, there were some very excellent students, excellent from a character standpoint, scholastic standpoint, and in every way were good fraternity material. But they had one handicap at the time, apparently, and that was that they were Jewish students. And so a few of these students got
And the other fraternities did not accept them on that basis.
They were not accepted by any of the fraternities on the campus, but were barred on because they were Jews. Goldie Goldstein, who was one of the outstanding football players that the university has ever had, was typical of some of these students. And he and a few others saw me, and on the basis of that, they started a fraternity which became the Phi Beta Delta Fraternity.
Were you the only Jewish faculty person at that time?
I think so.
Mr. Brest had left.
That's right, I think so. And then at the it was about that time that Willie Edelstein and I think the Roberts boy got interested and started the TEP fraternity.
So there were two Jewish fraternities then organized about the same time.
About the same time.
where did the 5BDs hold their, did they have a fraternity house? Where did they hold their activities?
They, at first, they were just held almost any of the boys' rooms. There were only a little handful. And then they rented a residence on the campus, and it got so that, especially after they grew a little bit, that the most that they could hold in the house was about a year, because after that it was so badly wrecked that you couldn't live in it the second year without a lot of rehabilitation. And
so they moved around.
So they moved around almost on a 1 to 2 year basis every year. I think the Tep fraternity was more fortunate. They got what I believe was originally built to be a hotel on University Avenue, about 5 blocks from the school. They had some of the local people particularly who could afford to do so, help finance the situation so that they had a house, and I think that they got situated more permanently in a permanent home than the Phi Beta Delta fraternity did. Later, the Phi Beta fraternity amalgamated with the Pi Lambda Phi fraternity, and that's the name it now has.
One of the early houses I remember, the 5ED house, was on the corner of what is now 12th and University. I guess it was about 8th and University. There was a large house, and it's still standing behind some stores today. Oh, do you remember that, about 1933, 1934?
I've lived in so many houses, it's hard for me to remember.
You wouldn't want to try and back in any of that kind of thing. What was your role as a faculty advisor?
Running the thing, I suppose, would be the only thing I could say. In other words, I was the only member of the faculty, and certainly there was nobody in town, and there were no alumni involved, so that it became a one-man job of really directing these students and trying to get them on a financial, economic sound basis.
There were no black students, of course, on the campus in those days, and no women students, so the Jewish students were the major minority group, weren't they? Did they have any special problems other than the social problems?
I don't think so. Not that I know of. I think Jewish students were elected to student government offices. They played on athletic teams. They got awards and scholarship and so forth. And I don't, except for social discrimination, I didn't see any.
As you think back on it, then you were not subjected to any particular kind of anti-Semitism.
What do you mean by you?
You as an individual.
No, I don't think so. I don't think I was. I didn't always get something that I might want somewhere, but I felt reasonably sure that if I had been a non-Jew, I would have also been denied that particular thing. There were not many cases that came up, but in the few cases that it did come up, I could see the reasonableness of the other man having qualities better or as good as mine, and therefore he was entitled to it as well as I was.
You found Gainesville then to be an open, relatively liberal community, taking into consideration it was a small town and it was the South.
From a Jewish standpoint, I would say yes.
That's what I'm asking, from a Jewish standpoint, because you not only were living in it yourself, but your family was also living here.
I'll give it to you in another way. About 2 years after we came here, I found that there was no synagogue here or any place of worship for the Jewish people. They used to worship once a year down at the Masonic Temple. And I was very instrumental in getting several of the Jewish folks together and so that they could build a synagogue here in the town. And I know that as much money was paid in by the Christian community for that synagogue when it came in at first, as was done by the Jewish people. There were only about 10 families here, and there were not. There were. I don't think there was very. There wasn't anyone here that. Not more than one or two that you might be considered even somewhat wealthy. But a lot of money came in from the Christian community.
Did you supervise the building of the synagogue?
I took a part in it, but it was a community affair.
But I'm talking about the construction of it. It was let to a contractor, right?
Yes, I think it was let primarily to the contractor. I did not engineer it or act as an architect for it.
Now, you raised a family here in Gainesville, didn't you?
I have one son.
And that is Marvin.
Right.
And he is, where is Marvin now?
Right now he's on a sabbatical leave in Sweden, but he has an office in California.
He's a physician?
He's a neurologist, a pediatric neurologist.
Where did he get his education?
Graduated the public schools here, the P.K. Young School Laboratory School, and then he went to the University of Florida and got his degree with high honors at the age of 17, and then he went to Johns Hopkins and got his M.D. at 21. And then he served as an intern and resident at Duke at 23. And then he served as an officer in the Army in charge of setting up the virus and rickettsial disease laboratory at the Walter Reed Hospital. And then he left there and worked with Dr. Sabin in the development of the live polio vaccine. And then he went to Miami, where he set up an office in with Dr. Grayson. He was an associate with Dr. Grayson, and he had probably one of the largest pediatric practices on Miami Beach. And then from there, he got a grant from the NIH, and went to Johns Hopkins, and afterwards to the Brain Institute, Los Angeles, specializing in pediatric neurology. And now he is teaching that over there, and also has private practice.
Now, when did you retire from the university? What year?
1960, I have to think twice.
You retired in 1965. Were you 65 years of age then?
No, I was 70. That is, when I was 69 when I retired, come to think about it.
You retired as dean at the age of 65? No. I would like to get the story of the 65 retiring age is what I'm really leading to.
Well, I became dean in 1937.
Yes.
When I, in 1962, I would have been 25 years as dean.
Right.
So 2 years before that, I went to the president and told him that in 1962, I will be 65 years of age. I will have been dean for 25 years, and I will have been at the university for over 40 years. So that I felt that I would like to do something useful before I retire, and I would like to give up the deanship, so that he question it, but he said he didn't blame me.
You're talking Dr. J. Wayne Rice.
Right. I told him that I had had a policy in the College of Engineering that when a person gets to be 65, he is to give up his administrative duties as department head. He could become professor. And if that's what I believed in for my department heads, I felt I should follow, take the same medicine myself. And so I felt that when, in 1962, therefore, I should be able to retire as dean after 25 years of service. So then I retired as dean and became professor of biomedical engineering. I held that position for 3 years. And then went to the to New York Institute of Technology as provost. I stayed there for 3 years, and then came to the New York Institute to the Florida Institute of Technology, where I am at the present time acting as special assistant to the president.
Dean, while you have known a lot of the presidents of this university.
I've known all except the first one.
You knew Murphy?
No, Slid.
Taggart?
Slid.
I say, but you started with Murphy, you knew Taggart.
Well, Farr came in, I think, for a little period of time, too.
And you knew Hume, of course, he was acting president. Yeah. Dean Hume was a very splendid man.
Yeah.
And J. Hillis Miller and J. Wayne Wright. You served under all of those, didn't you?
Yeah.
How did J. Hillis Miller was a especially close friend of yours, wasn't he?
Yes.
Tell me about him. How you admired him as an administrator.
Well, he was one of the kindest men I think I've ever met. He was a very fair man, and he wanted to make sure that nothing unfair would be invoked upon anybody if he could help it. Now, I've been rather fortunate, although I have been in administrative work for many years, that only I can count on the fingers of my one hand the number of real difficult problems which harassed me. I can only think at the moment about three of them. Now, one of the worst problems that I had was that just before Dr. Miller came, about 2 years before, one of the professors got in trouble with his department head. And I didn't know whether it was the department head's fault or the professor's fault. But I knew both of them had peculiar characteristics. And so I asked the professor, I was swamped with work, would he like to come to my office and work with me for the time being? Well, that was a mistake that I made. He did. Well, the more than he came over, he began harassing me that he wanted the department head who had originally hired him fired. The reasons he gave were insufficient for me to feel that the man should be dismissed. I felt that the individual himself was in the wrong. Well, he took it upon himself then to see what he could do to harass me to get the action. And this came at a time when Taggart was still the dean, the president. I was up north, and when I got to Jacksonville on the way back, I got a message that Miss Pitts wanted me to call up. Miss Pitts was Dr. Taggart's secretary. And she told me to come back at once, that there was a real problem, that the Board of Control had not reappointed me for the coming year. I said, why? She said, well, you better come. So I was the longest ride I ever took from Jacksonville to Gainesville. Well, when I got there, and I went to see Tigard, and Tigard told me that the Border Control had decided that they were not going to reappoint me. I said that they had some complaints about me. I don't know whether they used the word charges or not, but there were complaints, and therefore they felt that they were not going to reappoint me. I said, well, what were their charges? He said, well, I'm not at liberty to tell you. I said, well, Dr. Tigard, this isn't fair. I said, if there are any complaints about me or anything of that nature, I said, I have the right to know what they are. I said, I've lived the kind of life that I've always felt that my son could walk in my footsteps and not have to apologize that he was there. I said, if I've done anything wrong, I want to know what it is. I want a hearing. And I would like to have an open hearing on the stage of the auditorium. I said, because I don't know of anything I've done wrong. I said, I know I'm being harassed by this man Derry, but those are not charges that should come against me. I said, that's just ridiculous, I said. Well, the truth of the matter, as I see it now, was that Tigard was leaving, a new president was coming in, and I'd heard that the Border Control was going to try to give the new president a clean slate of administrative offices. There was a new dean in the College of Education, in the law school, and in several of the other places. And now they hit, so engineering now was that this man had gone to one of the Border Control people in Jacksonville and told him some things about me. And so they harnessed on this thing to keep my name. But
what was his name, this complainer?
All right. So I left off where.
Well, you were saying that they wanted to make a clean slate.
Yeah, I think they were trying to make a clean break for the new president. Well, in the meantime, this thing went on and on and on now for several months, and I had to have an operation for hernia, I think it was, and so I had to go to Duke for this operation. And before I left, I had Irvin Clayton down in town was my attorney, and Irvin had a meeting with the board members, and they asked me to retire. I would resign. That they would then recommend me for retirement, and I would get 50% of my salary as long as I lived, see? So I said, no. I said, I can't do that. I said, until I have a hearing, why, I shall not be satisfied. I said, my name is the most important thing as far as I'm concerned, and I shall not I can't be bought off. So, in the meantime, the thing had gotten to Tallahassee. And one of the big problems that I had was that my friends in the cabinet were solidly behind me and wanted to step in. And I had to keep them off because I said, if you step in, it'll be a whitewash in the eyes of people. I said, if I've done anything wrong, I would have paid a penalty. But if I haven't, I ought to get a clear slate, and that can only come by a fair hearing. And all I want is a fair hearing, and that if, on the basis of that hearing, if I don't get a fair hearing, then I want you to step in, but otherwise, no. So anyway, I went to Duke, had my operation, and when I came back, pressure was put on me again by my attorney and by board members, some of them, to retire, and I wouldn't do it. So, in the meanwhile, they did not take me from the deanship, but they did not reappoint me. So I said, all right, I'll continue to serve, for then, provided, however, that it be understood that, that definite action will be taken, that the hearing will take place. Of course, I would have liked to put charges against the professor, but as long as he was putting charges against me, I would have to wait until his action was first taken care of. So at any rate, why, this dug on and on and on until Miller was made president. after Miller was made president, he and I had a short talk, in which he knew that I had this difficulty, and he said as soon as he had a chance, he would get with me and we would discuss the thing. I remember we went down to Primrose Grill, and we had lunch. And we first talked about it in the office, and we went down there and we had lunch. And then he said to me, after the lunch, we were walking down the street about this thing, he says, "Don't you think it would be to your advantage to eliminate this whole business and resign? I know you've got several offers for other positions, and in fact, the Naval Academy had offered me a position there as dean, so that basically the whole thing could be washed out this way." I looked at him, I said, "Dr. Miller," I said, "you know what you do in this case is going to be definitely something which your entire faculty is going to remember, how you act upon it." I said, "if you were in my place, would you resign at this time?" He says, "no," and he shook my hand. Well, the result of it was, he then insisted that I get a hearing. So this fellow then, he came before the board and he presented his bunch of crap that he had, which amounted to nothing. And then he, of course, they exonerated both me and they exonerated Williams. And then we immediately wanted to put charges against him, but he left town. We never could put the charges against him.
He left.
But so that was one of the most heart-rending eras of my life.
It lasted so long, too.
Yes, that's it, you see. That's what gets you.
I remember the first time I met Dr. Miller was at your home dinner party. That's how I first met him.
But we got to be pretty close.
Yeah. But he was a very fair man, and he did a fine job for the university.
Yes. So I mentioned the fact that this is one of the most heart-rending experiences of my entire life. The other one, I think, is that one of the problems that a dean has is that he wants to be fair to the individual, but his responsibility is also to the university. And occasionally he has to do things which might be harmful to the university, to the individual, on the fact that it's best for the university to let the man go. One of my difficulties along that line occurred several years ago, when before the electrical engineering department could give the PhD, I set out to, I felt that we had the opportunity here because of the expertise that we already had to give a good PhD in electrical engineering. And so I told the department head, Dr. Pumphrey, that for him to find a group of five men with PhDs who were qualified to give a high level program leading to the PhD in electrical engineering. And he found five men who were excellent men. I reviewed their records. I know what they're, and even today, I must say that from a technical standpoint, an educational standpoint, these men had ideal characteristics. They were good men. However, their ideas of how the electrical engineering department should proceed and the ideas that I as a dean had were in conflict. Now I realize that a faculty has certain prerogatives, but so has the dean. And I know that from the standpoint of the College of Engineering, we were not yet MIT, and therefore we had to get, while we could have a high-level program, we must have it at a scope which would be available to our graduates and the graduates of similar schools throughout the country. And that we could not do some of the things that they wanted to do, at least for some time to come, until we had established ourselves and our reputation for giving PhD degrees in life.